Hi, it's JV here. Due to its length, this episode of Beyond Reality with guest Tim Cohen has been divided into two podcasts and two YouTube videos, part one and part two. In part one, we discuss Tim's book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, which explores the current geopolitical climate as it relates to two of the most dangerous emerging nuclear powers in the world. In part two, we examine Tim's book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, in which Tim not only claims the Antichrist is already among us, he actually identifies him. Both are fascinating discussions. Please enjoy them, and thank you for your support.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go Beyond Reality.
Welcome to the program, everyone. It's Beyond Reality. I'm your host, JV Johnson. We have a spectacular program for you tonight. Tim Cohen will be with us. Tim is an author. He's going to be talking about the Antichrist. He says the Antichrist is here on Earth, and he knows who he is. That'll be an interesting conversation. We're also going to talk about North Korea, Iran, and the coming World War III that will involve those two nations as a flashpoint. Great conversation tonight. I'm really looking forward to it. Before we get too much further into the show, however, Tennessee obviously hit with an amazing natural disaster overnight. And our hearts and prayers go out to everyone who suffered loss of life or loss of property, or I just can't imagine that type of ordeal. I mean, we have storms in the country a lot, but for storms to kill 25 in a period of time as short as that just tells you the intensity of those storms. Mother Nature, when she rears her head and tries to make a point, she certainly does it with a vengeance. So again, our hearts and prayers go out to everyone who is touched by those storms. And for those of you who was a near miss, we're thankful you're all safe. So, and I know some of you in our chat room live in that area, so we're very, very glad you're safe. In other news, I mean, obviously, we're all paying attention to this coronavirus. It's up to 9 deaths, I believe, in Washington State, which seems to be the epicenter right now. However, there are cases reported all over the country. Well, not all over the country, but in many spots around the country. I think New York had a couple, New York City, that is. Although I had heard reports there were some in upstate New York, which gets pretty close to home for me. So again, just be smart about this. We talked last night about it, and we talked about the fact on several of our discussions here that it seems like there's just a lot of hype. And when you start doing the comparisons with deaths from influenza or other types of diseases that are also communicable, you start to recognize that this might not be the catastrophe that they're making it out to be. However, I keep coming back to one point. If that is in fact the case, and this is not something to worry about, the governments around the world are either just prone to hysteria or they're reacting to public hysteria and just trying to do something to keep people happy, or they know something we don't know. It's one of those things. And we're going to continue to ask those questions of anybody we can, and we may even ask our guest tonight if he's got an opinion on it. So keep yourself vigilant. Wash your hands. That's the best advice, of course. And be smart. The other thing, I mentioned the chat room. We do have some folks who are in the Tennessee area who close call for these storms. But when I talk about the chat room, I'm of course talking about our YouTube chat room. And if you haven't found our YouTube channel yet, you need to go to YouTube and search for JV Johnson, just my name. And when you find the channel, subscribe. We also encourage you to click the notification icon. That way you get a notification when we go live or we upload bonus material, which we do as well. And that's a great way to join our online community. It's a place that we all gather during the live stream in the chat room, that is, and talk about what we're talking about during the show, plus some other things. We have a little fun in there, too. In fact, usually after we let our guest go on the program, we have we play some games, do a little trivia and stuff in the chat room. It's a lot of fun. So again, go to YouTube, search for JV Johnson. When you find the channel, please subscribe. Also, find us on Facebook. It's JV Johnson on Facebook and also Beyond Reality Radio. I encourage you to like both of those pages so you can follow us when we post there as well. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. We're excited to have our guest, Tim Cohen, with us. Tim is an author. He's also an internationally known teacher, speaker, researcher, analyst, and computer technologist. He's wrote 4 years of high school computer programming curriculum for the Denver Public Schools while in junior high. And as a high school sophomore, was a Silicon Valley research intern with Atari at 16. He also took first place in the Colorado-Wyoming Science Talent Competition at 18 and was recognized for his early computer science work by the U.S. Department of Education, the Colorado State Board of Education, the Denver Public Schools Superintendents and Board of Education, and others. Cohen attended the U.S. Air Force Academy, class of 1998, and he served in the U.S. Air Force. Tim, that's quite a resume, but I get the impression you took a shining to IT and technology early in life. What drew you to that?
Yeah, I did. And just to mention, it was class of 88 rather than 98. I'm a little older than I sounded there.
Okay.
It was a junior high school math class. The teacher was friends with the fellow running the first high school computer lab in the country at George Washington High School. And I asked the teacher when I had gotten to programmable calculators at the age of 12, you know, if I aced my exam with my calculator, would he allow me to be involved with George Washington High School's computer lab? And all that worked out. That's what happened. And I was working there before and after school throughout junior high from that point forward, and also over the summers, and being given computers to use, etc. So by the time I was 14, I was actually quite advanced in computers for that time, and writing high school computer curricula for DPS.
You mentioned a programmable calculator. I remember getting my first programmable calculator, and it was one of those Texas Instruments. Now it'd be a paperweight, pretty much. And it had a little strip, a little magnetic strip that you would slide through it, you know, to save or load software. Are we talking about that kind of programmable calculator or something a little more advanced?
These were a little more advanced. The first one I had was a Casio, surprisingly, okay, which was quite fancy, and it had a port on it where you could program it to play through a program, Fleur de Lis, and some other music. And so I initially was messing around with that, and then the next one I had was an HP 41C, which was an RPN, programmable calculator, reverse Polish notation, quite an advanced calculator for the time. And so that's what I started with.
Well, when we have these conversations, I can't help but think back. I, too, took a real interest in computers when they first started to become available. Radio Shack, the Tandy TRS-80 or whatever the heck it was the first one I got to fool around on, other than the one that was in the guidance office in my high school that had no monitor. It just used paper. And to think how far we've come in the fact that this smartphone I carry around in my pocket almost all of the time, puts those devices to shame with its computing ability.
It does. Yeah, I used to have fun, actually, with the TRS-80s going into the Radio Shack stores and crashing them. I'd write a little program there in front of the salesman and crash the machines right in front of them.
Not a very nice thing to do, but
I thought it was fun.
Some kids throw snowballs at cars. You went into the computer store and crashed their computers. I see.
Right.
How it goes. It's just really remarkable to think how far we've come. But somewhere along the way, you started to turn your attention to some other things. We're going to be talking about some of your books tonight, including The Antichrist and A Cup of Tea, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War. At what point obviously you maintain that interest in technology and computers, but at some point you started to look at some other things, too. When did that fork in your road come?
1986, the year I became a Christian. I had no interest, actually, in a lot of the things that I've pursued since then, other than programming, of course. God just changed the course of my life and made me interested in things that were extremely boring, like history to me prior to that, etc.
And you said God changed your life. Did he speak to you?
At times, yes.
But when you had this epiphany, was it God speaking to you?
No, not initially. I attended a home church in Colorado Springs. A classmate of mine, a computer science major like myself, invited me to go, and I said, "What's it about?" And he said, "Bible prophecy." And I said, "Oh, I didn't know there was prophecy in the Bible." And of course, at that time, I was a New Ager. I had gotten into the occult a bit. I was convinced that maybe it was possible to tell something about someone's future through mystic type things, tarot cards and so forth. And so I was simply curious and went with him. And after a few weeks of attending and not, you know, drawing any real conclusions, the pastor talked about Isaiah 53 and the Messiah being a guilt offering for the world. And something snapped in me, literally. I can't describe it any other way than that, for no rational reason at all. I simply believed. I mean, the only thought I had was, okay, so there is justice in the end. You know, and I was looking at the world at that time and thinking, you know, mankind could be pretty evil. We're going to wipe this planet out if we're not careful, and maybe it would be better if something other than us arose in our place that might take better care of the world and the life in it. And that was my thought pattern. And then when I realized that there was justice in the world, it's like God just reached in and snapped something, and I believed. And I prayed that day to receive Jesus, Yeshua, as the Messiah and as my Savior. And I literally, physically felt the Holy Spirit enter me at that moment. And I've never heard any other Christian describe that experience like that. But that's what happened to me. And everything changed after that for me.
Yeah, I can't say I've heard that description either. That's quite amazing. Let's talk a little bit. I was going to actually talk about the Antichrist research you've done and information that you have that you've included in your book first. But I kind of want to reverse this a little bit because, you know, obviously we're looking at something that seems to be, if you ask one group of people, an overhyped problem, and you ask another group of people, it's a very serious health threat. This coronavirus that started in China and has rapidly spread around the world. I'm not sure what you think about it, whether it's overhype or it's justifiably something we should panic about. But I want to know if you've got an insight on the geopolitical aspects of this.
Well, I'll say a couple things. We know that the virus supposedly began in the vicinity of two bioweapons and biological laboratories, and I'll call them bioweapons because they're in China, but two highly secure biological laboratories, one within 20 miles, supposedly the epicenter of the beginning of this virus. And secondly, it's not a particularly dangerous virus in terms of death percentage, but it is particularly dangerous in terms of how easily it spreads and the fact that it can hide for up to 3 weeks in somebody with no symptoms before they become ill, meaning it's almost impossible to stop it in terms of borders and precautions. And when I look at something like that, I have to wonder, okay, is it possible that it's a dry run, or is it possible that they want to know how quickly it spreads, how much of the population gets infected, you know, what the effectiveness is in trying to stop it before putting something worse out there that might have similar genes to make it easily transmit. So I'm not so sure that it isn't some sort of dry run. I certainly hope that's not the case.
And of course, when you say dry run, you're talking about some type of biological weapon.
I am.
Yeah. You know, there are people that are talking about that. I mean, there are people in the federal government that are talking about that. And originally, the first mention of it was greeted with people saying, oh, you're just a conspiracy nut. But now it seems to be discussed a little bit more seriously. So do you think, would you fall on that side, that this very easily could have been engineered in a lab?
Engineered completely, no. Tweaked, very possibly. And certainly it would be, if it were intentional, you couldn't get more ideal than this scenario for a dry run. And that's why it looks so suspicious.
Right. One of the countries that is most affected right now is Iran. And obviously, Iran is one that you've looked at pretty closely and actually name in the title of your book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War. Tell me about Iran. What's going on there? Not as far as the coronavirus, but just politically.
Well, politically, you have a large population in Iran that isn't particularly happy with its leadership. And not necessarily moving in the same direction of the leadership, but nevertheless under a form of really totalitarian control. And then you have the pie-in-the-sky hopefuls in the West who think that maybe if there's enough support for that population that they might overthrow the government that's in place there. And something like that could happen, but I think that coronavirus, frankly, has a better chance of bringing something like that about than anything that we have done to try to support any revolutionary activity over there. But Iran is a country that explicitly, in terms of its leadership, you know, in Tehran, repeatedly states that it wants to destroy Zionism and the Zionist government in Israel. And a lot of people take that to mean something akin to a Holocaust or a genocide against Israel. I don't really believe that that's what the leaders in Tehran intend or mean. But when they talk about, quote-unquote, Palestinians are talking about Jew and non-Jew alike in the land, and they just think that Israel has an evil government. At the same time, they're willing to perpetrate some degree of genocide to try to eliminate Israel as a nation state and supplant it with, say, a quote-unquote Palestinian state. So they're a great threat to Israel in that regard. Additionally, as I document in the book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War, there is a strong, compelling reason to believe that Iran actually detonated its first nuclear bomb in a test as early as 2008, that they've had nukes this entire time, and that they have access to North Korean nuclear warheads and presumably missile technology. There's been a lot of exchange in that regard, and Iranian scientists have been present for every North Korean nuclear test that has been made publicly known. So Iran is a dangerous country. If the government gets overthrown, then the whole situation could change rapidly, but I think we're headed for war.
Now, Iran was an ally of the United States for a long time. That changed in 1979. And since then, they've proclaimed to be an adversary, and they've called the United States the Great Satan. If Iran does ultimately get an arsenal of nuclear weapons, will they use them, A, on Israel, B, somewhere in the United States, even if they can't deliver them via missile, you know, a dirty bomb situation, or just a nuclear device in, you know, downtown New York City or something like that? Do we have to fear this?
We do, and I think the threat is a little bit more complicated. I think that, first of all, Iran is actually a rational actor for the most part where nuclear weapons are concerned, particularly in the Middle East. I don't see Iran hitting Israel with a nuclear weapon unless it is as a defensive or retaliation measure. And I could see Israel striking Iran with nuclear weapons if it was deemed necessary to prevent Iran from threatening Israel with a nuke or hitting Israel with a nuke. I think that Israel's government has been dishonest with the public and has played politics with the public concerning the real nuclear situation with Iran. Like I said, I believe Iran is already nuclear armed. Iran has boasted of the ability, they've claimed the ability to easily take out our aircraft carriers there in the Gulf. And of course, if they were able to hit, and I'm not saying they would do this, but if they could hit an aircraft carrier with a single nuke, they could sink one, probably pretty easily. Mm-hmm. So there's that concern. And in terms of the United States, our homeland, there was a lot of talk when North Korea last tested an ICBM about the fact that it broke up at roughly, I think it was 70 kilometers, if I remember right, altitude, 70 miles or 70 kilometers, I forget. But in any case, the claim was, okay, they don't have the ability to get a warhead all the way through the atmosphere to actually strike a city on the ground yet, and therefore they're not quite such a threat that we need to go in and militarily pounce them or something like that. The reality is what North Korea was doing was an EMP dry run, an electromagnetic pulse attack dry run. And Iran has done the exact same thing off their own coasts with their ballistic missiles already. And what that means is if they could detonate a nuke at that altitude, they could take out much of our electric grid. Iran has talked about, and they haven't done it yet to my knowledge, but they've talked about in the last few years, sending ships, you know, across the seas, as it were, to our own coast, just like we do to them and have done to them for decades. They've talked about this. And if they or North Korea got a ship off our coast, it could even be by stealth. It could be a shipping container, you know, that has a missile to launch, you know, or if they got a submarine off our coast and they launched a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile and detonated it at altitude, it would only take one or two of those to potentially take out our electric grid for, you know, a year to 10 years and kill up to 90 million of our, you know, 90 to 100 million pretty easily over a course of 10 to 12-month period by starvation and disease and so forth, because literally our whole system is ground to a halt. And they have practiced this scenario as a dry run in both countries. So I think the threat is far more dire than the public has been told. I believe that our defense establishment is very aware of that, and that this is one reason President Trump has not gone after North Korea militarily yet beyond threats, and same thing with Iran. So I think we're in a difficult situation.
Explain how detonating a nuclear device in the atmosphere as an EMP device knocks out the U.S. power grid for maybe, you said, up to 10 years.
Yes. So we have, well, first of all, an EMP works by sending a strong electromagnetic surge through wires, you know, on the ground and just beneath the ground.
Right.
To basically fry electronics and electrical circuits. But one side effect it has is to take out unprotected generators and transmission stations. So we have roughly 300 large, I think it is, but hundreds of large transformers in this country, which are mostly not built here. They're custom built, and they take a long time to build and put in place, each one of them. And they're not hardened in our grid against EMP, you know, which means a solar event, you know, like the Carrington event of the 1800s could also do the same thing to our grid that an intentional nuclear attack could do. So what that is saying is that there's the possibility that one or two nukes detonated at altitude over the central U.S. could fry those main transmission areas, not just the lines, but those transformers. And we wouldn't have the ability to bring the grid back online for an extended period of time if that happened. And the travesty of this whole thing, JV, is that, you know, for billions of dollars, we're not talking about a huge amount of money in terms of our annual national budget. It's actually a relatively small amount of money, maybe $20 billion. I've heard different figures. But for a few billion dollars, relatively speaking, we could harden our grid, and we could do it relatively quickly to mitigate this threat. And I don't understand why it hasn't been done already. You know, our own military relies upon the civilian electric grid. You know, people tend to think the military is offline, its own systems are hardened, it's got backup power generation and storage for some period of time. But the reality is, once that runs out, it's hooked into the civilian grid. And if the civilian grid is down, our own military ends up being paralyzed.
Is there anybody in the federal government screaming at the top of their lungs about this or making any noise whatsoever about this?
Oh, several people have. And in fact, it's been a big agenda since the 1990s, at least. It just hasn't been addressed. And it makes me wonder if it isn't some sort of behind-the-scenes, you know, mutually assured destruction kind of conspiracy where people are thinking along the lines of the Cold War, okay, if Russia does this to us, we'll do it to them. Or if China does this to us, we'll do it to them. That kind of thinking never really accounted for what we'll call rogue states like North Korea or Iran.
Right.
You know, where Iran says, well, okay, if you do it to us, we're more capable of living, you know, without the grid for an extended period. Plus, you know, our martyrs will just go to heaven.
Right.
And North Korea is a country that says, well, if you kill us, you know how it is with the Japanese kamikazes. We'll come at you twice as hard, you know, till you're dead, even if it kills us. So these are not rational actors. They don't have the same calculus. And on top of that, North Korea has a mutual defense treaty with China. And if China were to act on that, we would, you know, for that and other reasons that I discuss, in North Korea, Iran, in the coming World War, we'd quickly find ourselves in World War, not just some regional war where the United States is, you know, severely threatened with an EMP attack or something like that. It can get far worse.
Has the U.S. government been negligent in letting this genie out of the bottle, letting Iran get to the point where it could very well have already developed a nuclear device? Certainly North Korea has.
Oh, there's no question that there's been negligence. There's been dishonesty. You know, Israel found a cache of documents, a large cache of documents that it brought out before my book was published, in fact, and showed the world that Iran had been lying to the public and to the international community this whole time and had, in fact, pursued the development of nuclear weapons and had, in fact, stored the technical know-how to bring that effort back online and quickly produce nuclear weapons, even though they weren't supposed to have retained any of that. And what has the world done? Well, to this point, we're only now, literally now, like today even, seeing the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, say to Iran, explain this, you know, some of this stuff. And this is years after it was exposed by Israel, for example. And then the same thing was happening under the Obama administration, where there were all these claims about how the world would be a safer place. You know, Iran would abide by these agreements, the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it's called, you know, which is an agreement between Iran and then mostly the members of the Security Council, the permanent members of the UN Security Council. But in any case, it's clear that Iran hasn't abided by that. But additionally, none of these actors, including Israel, have been honest about the real state of Iran's nuclear weapons development before the JCPOA was even a glimmer in anyone's, you know, mind, meaning going back to the 2008 time frame where Iran tested a nuclear bomb. And so there's every reason to believe that Iran could have a cache of warheads that the public doesn't know about, or if they don't, that they can get that fairly quickly, and that they may have access to that from North Korea. So lots of dishonesty. The danger is real, and I think nobody's really dealing with it with integrity yet. And I think so, well, for that reason, it's kind of a situation of too little, too late.
In January of 2002, George W. Bush, following the terrorist attacks, of course, of 9/11, proclaimed the axis of evil, being Syria, Iran, and North Korea. I don't know, you know, if we know what happened in Iraq, of course, but I don't know if there were additional plans at that point to address the potential of a nuclear Iran and a nuclear North Korea. At that point, they may not have been there yet. And maybe the unpopularity of the Iraq war stopped those plans. Do you know if that was ever the case?
Well, roughly the 2005 timeframe is when North Korea really became publicly known for developing a nuclear weapon and had claimed to have tested one. And in our, you know, major news media, that was mostly discounted, and then, of course, later we found out it was true. Now, North Korea has tunnels, you know, going across and under the border into all sorts of places in South Korea, meaning they've had the ability for quite some time potentially to plant bombs just beneath the surface in South Korea. That's a real threat. We don't hear a lot about that in the news. And so even when we go back to the time frame of what Bush Jr., I'll call him, you know, George W. Bush, not Herbert Bush, but George W. Bush,
right?
You know, when they were talking about dealing with Iran and North Korea, nobody was really taking it seriously. It's the same thing that politicians have always done, kick the can down the road till you can't anymore, till it turns into some terrible disaster. And in the meantime, the public is happy with you.
Right.
And that's what we've seen again and again and again. And I think President Trump has come in and said, wait a minute, we can't do this. We can't do business as usual. And so he's terminated the U.S. participation in the JCPOA. He's more or less towed Israel's public line in terms of the Iranian threat. Again, still no honesty, really, in terms of their potential real nuclear weapons capabilities. But he has publicly become much more stern about it. And the same thing with North Korea. You know, there are accounts that Obama, when transitioning the presidency to President-elect Trump, told him that the number one thing he was going to have to deal with, and quickly, was North Korea. So why didn't Obama deal with it? Since he knew that. You know, and of course, we've played this game with North Korea where President Trump has tried to be lovey-dovey with Kim Jong-un. And how has that turned out? Well, North Korea has accused the United States over the last year and even before that of stalling for time. These are their words. They've accused the Trump administration of stalling for time with these sanctions and so forth. But the reality is the opposite. It's North Korea that's been stalling for time, and they've done it successfully. And what they've accomplished in this period of not actually testing ballistic missiles that would be intermediate or long range is potentially the development of a submarine capable of launching a ballistic missile, a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile. And there's concern that they may actually have that online at this point, or will very soon. And additionally, in the last few months, of testing what appears to be a solid rocket fuel engine. And if they were to bring that online with their next set of ballistic missiles, it would mean that we'd have very little forewarning, potentially, if any forewarning, of a ballistic missile launch. You know, say a nuclear-tipped ballistic missile with a solid rocket engine could be launched in short order, and we wouldn't have much, if any, forewarning. So the situation has actually become much more dangerous because of this lovey-dovey approach that President Trump has taken. And in the end, as always happens in these situations where you're dealing with mad individuals, and I will go so far as to say the reality that Bible prophecy will be fulfilled, in the end it'll come back and it'll bite us hard.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Tim Cohen tonight. We're talking about his book, North Korea, Iran, and the Coming World War. We are going to talk about the Antichrist and his book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, as well as we continue this conversation. But, Tim, you know, these ideas and these threats have existed for a while. What made you decide to write a book about this?
Well, I assume you're talking about the book on North Korea and Iran?
Yes.
So I actually began that in 2008. And the thing that spurred me to do it, and of course I've been looking at Bible prophecy for a long time before that, but the thing that spurred me to write this particular book and to look at it in more detail is that I realized that the second seal of the apocalypse in Revelation was talking about North Korea and Iran. You know, I point out in my book, The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, that the imagery that Christians for so long and others, you know, let alone Christians, have believed was not literal and had to be mystical or mythical in some fashion or, you know, whatever. This bizarre imagery that you find in Revelation, this symbolism, had believed that it was not going to be literal, that in some fashion it would be metaphysical, metaphorical, etc. But I realized with the Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, while I was still at the Air Force Academy, by the way, that imagery is in fact literal. And it turns out that the second seal of Revelation, which deals with a rider who goes forth on a fiery red horse and is given a sword with which to take peace from the earth, is actually talking about North Korea and Islam, but in this case more specifically Iran, and then ultimately it encompasses the United States and Saudi Arabia and other actors. So when we talk about the fiery red horse, that's actually the national symbol, JV, of North Korea. And a statue of that horse, which is supposed to be a fiery red Pegasus from Asian mythology, called Kolima or Konoma, overlooks downtown Pyongyang. It's a huge statue. It's not red in color during the daytime, but they light it up at certain ceremonies at different times of the year with fiery red torches, so it looks kind of red, but it's also depicted on their currency as a fiery red Pegasus and in other symbols throughout North Korea. And they even have named a number of their military armaments, like tanks and aircraft and so forth, after this fictional fiery red horse or Pegasus. And the idea is that it's a fiery red horse that can leap great distances in a single bound. And so they chose it as their national symbol. And the United States, of course, was aware of this. And so we had the Red Horse Brigades, that's an acronym, facing off against North Korea during the Korean War, because we understood that the Red Horse was their national symbol, so we, you know, faced them with brigades that we decided to call Red Horse. And in terms of the alliance, and that's what it is, between North Korea and Iran, you know, we look at Islam as the religion of the sword. That's what Muslims say of it themselves. You know, they call it the religion of the sword, and we recognize it as that in the West. And if you look at most of the national flags of a lot of the Muslim countries, you'll see a sword associated with them or on them.
That's right.
In the case of Iran and Saudi Arabia, both, they have that sword on them. And speaking of the Red Pegasus, let me just mention, you know, Rex Tillerson, our former Secretary of State, the first Secretary of State under President Trump, was the former CEO of ExxonMobil Corporation, right?
Yep.
And ExxonMobil came out of a merger that involved Mobil Oil. And Mobil Oil had, for its original symbol, the fiery Red Pegasus. You know, a Red
That's
Pegasus.
That's right, yeah.
And you can still see that on, you know, older gas station memorabilia, you know, or paraphernalia, whatever you want to call it. So we had the former CEO of a company represented by that Red Horse, and still is today, by the way, represented by that Red Pegasus. We had that CEO, you know, with the Trump administration in Saudi Arabia, you know, when things were really heating up, facing off against North Korea and Iran. With the other side, if you want to say it, the other half of that coin, of the same symbolism. So all that ties into the fiery red horse, which is the second seal of the apocalypse, and each of those seven seals between Revelation 6 and later is roughly one seal per year in the final 7 years preceding Jesus' return, Christ's return, and Armageddon. So in other words, I'm looking for these events to take place roughly in the second year of the final 7 years preceding Armageddon. So we're not there yet, but we're quickly getting there.
How does China fit into all this? I mean, we've been told quite a bit recently that China is what we would consider to be our number one adversary. We've got to really pay attention to what they're doing. Their economy is poised to overtake the U.S. economy and be the world's largest. They hold a lot of our debt. How do they fit into this scenario?
Well, I think it's bigger than just China or North Korea or Iran or the United States. And I address this in the book. So just to throw out a few plausible scenarios, we have India and Pakistan, both nuclear armed, facing off against one another. Multiple close calls for major warfare between them. Over the decades since they've been nuclear armed. We have China wanting to take control of Taiwan. You know, and we're supposed to be in some fashion protecting Taiwan and, of course, providing armaments to Taiwan, which really upsets China to this day still. But China wants to take Taiwan. We have a mutual defense treaty between China and North Korea. And China, for a while, early in the Trump administration, when they realized how serious we were, you know, about potentially attacking North Korea, and we got very close already. But when they realized how serious we were, they basically said, look, if North Korea, you know, hits you guys with a nuclear missile, attacks you first, we will not step in to defend North Korea. We will set aside our mutual defense treaty that we have with them. And by the way, that treaty is still in effect. It doesn't expire yet. They renew it every so many years. It's still in effect. But on the other hand, if you attack North Korea, we will step in on behalf of North Korea as part of that defense treaty, you know, if you initiate it, and there will be war, including with China. Now, of course, you also have Russia and Ukraine, right? And the concern that the European Union and NATO have that Russia could decide to go further than it already has with trying to take control of these areas in Ukraine, meaning it could potentially seek to invade Europe. You have Germany and France and even to an extent England and other members of NATO that the Trump administration has said, hey, you guys aren't pulling your weight. You're not paying your bills for NATO, for our alliance. We're not so sure that it's a good idea to maintain this alliance if you're not going to pay your bills. Why should the U.S. be doing this for you to such an extent so many decades after World War II? You know, and so there was a real risk of destabilization, and I think to some extent there still is of NATO. But in the mix with that, you've got Germany very unhappy with the United States over our efforts to try to nix transportation of gas and nix the idea of having Russia as a major energy supplier to Germany, because in our minds that weakens NATO and makes NATO more vulnerable to Russian action in the event of any future major conflict that involves NATO against Russia and vice versa. But Germany is very unhappy with our interference in that arena. And then you get Turkey. You know, Turkey, by many standards, does not belong in NATO and is drawing close to Russia, kind of like Germany sort of seems to want to do, is on the fence with, to some extent. So in other words, we have a situation, JV, where NATO is not so stable as it should be, where it is being undermined from multiple directions, where in the event of a war with North Korea, we could see Iran get involved, and so we could see major conflagration within the Middle East. We could see China get involved and go after Taiwan, at the same time thinking that the U.S. is occupied on the Korean Peninsula as well as in the Middle East. We could see Russia make a grab for some other portion of Europe, maybe wanting to reestablish some version of the former Soviet Union. And then we could see war at any time, really, between India and Pakistan. And those are just the major examples. There are others. But we could see some combination or all of those things realistically happen in short order, simultaneously or together, in the event that war occurs between the United States and Iran and or North Korea. And so we're talking about a situation where we would very quickly find ourselves stretched too thin.
Does that scenario necessarily devolve into a nuclear war? Is there any chance that any conflicts that we were just talking about would remain conventional?
Well, I think they could, for some period of time, remain conventional, certainly with North Korea. I mean, even if you set aside nuclear capabilities or nuclear threats from North Korea, they've got a terrible conventional threat towards South Korea. But also, they've got chemical and biological capabilities, particularly chemical, but we believe also biological. So they don't have to resort immediately to nuclear weapons unless they feel that that's what they need to do to take the United States off the board or to try to take us off the board. You've got, and I didn't mention this, but you've got also the Trump administration questioning, you know, the alliance with South Korea and the bill that we've been footing in. Previously, the Trump administration was demanding that South Korea pay more of that bill, just like it's been doing toward our NATO allies for NATO. You know, and so South Korea did up its payment. But now, this year, the Trump administration is saying to South Korea, we want at least $5 billion, I think the number is, which is five times, you know, what they more recently paid. And South Koreans are getting angry over that. And frankly, it's not an unreasonable request at all on the part of the United States. But the South Koreans are saying, hey, this is kind of sudden. You know, it doesn't seem like a very nice way to treat an ally, and they're just not very happy with us.
Yeah.
So there's that issue. And anyway, bring me back on track because I digressed for a moment.
This is all fascinating, but I do have a question about the Soviet Union. How did we go from a collapse of a Cold War, of our single, really, Cold War adversary, loss of all their satellite states, East Germany and the Balkans and Czechoslovakia, and a carving up of what was a major geopolitical force into many smaller states, including Russia, But yet Russia seems to be still a major threat, despite the fact, if I understand correctly, Russia has the economy, has an economy the size of Texas.
Isn't that amazing? You have to wonder how these countries are able to arm themselves the way they do for such a small percentage of our own budgets, you know, militarily. So that's a whole other discussion as to where our own budgets are really going, you know, militarily. It's a reasonable question and a reasonable discussion. But that being said, we do face a major adversary with Russia, and I think that part of the issue is there was this attitude of peace in our time, you know, with the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Right.
And the breakup of the Soviet Union and this idea that we're all going to be one big happy family now. And people tend to forget there was a Soviet military strategist in the past who talked about the very scenario that has played out over the last few decades occurring, and that when it had played out, Russia would resurge, the Soviet Union, in his mind, in some form would resurge, and they would smash the West. Because what would we be doing? We would be lazy thinking it's peace in our time. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, that is what played out up until the Trump administration, where this current U.S. administration has been trying to deal with things that were allowed to become decrepit, publicly anyway, in our military, and we still face a number of issues in that regard that are going to take years to redress. So while we are trying to get back on track, we face adversaries with Russia and China that are vastly more dangerous than they were two decades ago.
And in the 90s, the United States was instrumental in orchestrating funding for Russia as it emerged as a quote-unquote democracy. And it seems like that money was just basically just fueled the creation of an adversary.
Well, you know, I talk about, and this is where it's easy to get into conspiracy theory type things, but in the Antichrist Nikapatia, I talk about certain geopolitical things in relation to types of government and experiments that the so-called elite have conducted over not just decades but centuries. And when we look at the situation after the Soviet Union and we had a real opportunity to turn Russia into an actual ally, and the Russians were feeling, to a large extent, optimistic toward the West and even friendly.
That's right.
Toward the West. They were becoming friendly in their attitudes. Then you get the Bush administration there, Bush Jr., and that starts to get a little colder, you know, but we're still playing more or less nice. And then you get the Obama administration. And all of a sudden, when there's this talk of hitting the reset button and making things more friendly with Russia, the opposite is what's really occurring. And then when you see Trump running for office, suddenly you've got this deep state nonsense of, Russia has, you know, empowered Trump to try to become president of the United States, is trying to assist that effort. There must be some collusion with Russia, this evil adversary, and turning the situation not just based on fraud, but almost intentionally, very adversarial. With and toward Russia. And of course, Russia's sitting back looking at this and saying, hey, you guys are nuts. We didn't do these things, but why are you even bothering to claim that we did, you know, for the most part?
Right.
There is some guilt there, but...
Yeah, some Facebook ads.
That was claimed.
Some Facebook ads. Wasn't it Mitt Romney, when he was running against Obama, that said, and he was ridiculed for it, said that Russia is going to be our biggest threat and we really need to pay attention to this?
I think Mitt Romney went that direction, but honestly, I didn't vote for the guy and didn't have much.
I just remember him being ridiculed for that, and he's been a little bit vindicated, I would say, for having that foresight. Anyway, we're talking with Tim Cohen. One more question before we wrap up the discussion on this particular topic, and then we'll go to break. But if you had to look at our doomsday clock, if you will, how close to midnight are we?
Well, you know, almost as a matter of course, they move it closer, it seems, each year. I actually think it's moved back a little bit since we were looking at these really on edge scenarios with North Korea about a year and a half ago. So I'd say we're probably right now about 3 minutes from midnight. But the thing is, I don't think it's going to move, you know, a minute at a time. I think it's going to move very rapidly to midnight when the time comes.
Right. Be sure to join us for part two of this discussion with guest Tim Cohen on Beyond Reality.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.